Not only did Alito say, you have to prove that this was done racially, okay? And not just along partisan lines, which, by the way, is always going to be the case, because who the fuck would crack? We don't have black power and white power in our state legislatures. We have Republicans and Democrats. Who the fuck is going to gerrymander anything beyond partisan lines? The whole point of a gerrymander is to win seats. Who do you know that's so racist that they're like, those goddamn blacks in Memphis, I think they're going to vote Republican, but we got to crack it anyway. We got to get these guys. We got to dilute that to some Democratic votes, okay? Because I think they're going to, but they're just so black and I hate them because they're black. And even though they're going to vote for us, we got to get rid of them. We got to dilute it to Democratic votes. So every partisan is definitionally going to be gerrymander. You partisan a district based on the electoral outcomes. That's what you're partisaning. That's what you're dividing it for. That's the whole point, is who they vote for. But Alito said, not only do you have to prove, okay, that they were giggling and emailing N-words back and forth to each other, you have to provide a map that satisfies every single condition that was non-racial that the state was trying to satisfy anyway. So even if you can prove it, you have to give them a map that does the exact same partisan shit, which is the only reason you would ever gerrymander in the first place. It's crazy.
It's rough times right now, guys. I haven't looked up the rationale for it because I just saw sentences on it. I was like, I don't think nobody reads court decisions, so they never accurately summarize anything. And I'm hoping that this was not accurately summarized. There was a challenge to a big gerrymander. Either the Supreme Court or the state Supreme Court said something like, just because the primary is already happening doesn't mean that we have to talk. It was basically the exact opposite rationale. Now, to be fair, they could have like a different constitution or a different set of laws, but I shouldn't have read either of those decisions. They are just so bad. I wish more people would just like go through. They're comically horrible decisions. They're just crazy. What decision are you talking about now? The Alito decision. Anybody that says differently, I need you guys to just fucking please spam the fuck out of this you see anywhere, because I know every motherfucker is going to say this. I know a bunch of center left lib fucks are going to say this too, because they're trying to seem nonpartisan. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that forbade racial gerrymandering is completely gone. You can racial gerrymandering is de facto legal in the United States of America. And if anybody says differently, you can disregard every single possible opinion they could have about law, this, or anything else, because they're a partisan shell fuck, or they just don't read, okay? It is just as a quick thing, the rationale that Alito deploys here is flawless. Alito says minority voters, okay, have a right to have their vote heard and their voice represented, okay? However, when it comes to minority voters, we're not talking about parties, we're talking about minorities. So in cases where the minorities are all voting for one party, and, well, we're not going to worry about the whites. If the minorities are voting for one party, as long as you can show that they're all voting for one party, you can argue that any gerrymander you do is just on partisan lines, which is legal in the United States. You can have partisan gerrymanders. So therefore, I can look at any Democratic district I want. I'm not exaggerating, okay? I know it sounds sometimes like I'm not exaggerating. You can look at any Democratic district you want, and you can gerrymander the fuck out of the district, and it's okay because you can always say that, well, I'm doing it on partisan lines. And they took this Gingles test, and they raped and mutated it into, Kagan suggested calling it the Calais, I don't know, I always fuck the pronunciation, the Calais test or whatever, which you should. It's not a rework to Gingles test or Jingles test. It's so stupid that Alito wanted to fucking say this. They've destroyed this test. And the threshold, the burden that you have to meet at every single step, it used to be, Jingles was a case where they, you know, how do you prove that there's a minority that needs to be represented in the House in order to have a vote or whatever? And there were, I'm not going to remember, but there was like a four-part test. It was three preconditions you had to meet. You have to be able to show that there's a minority voter of sufficient size. You have to be able to show that they live in a contiguous area, so they can't be spread across the state. And then you have to show that they are voting in a way that is contrary to like the majority population block. And then if you can do all of that, then you can draw a district basically that protects their right to have some kind of voice or representative heard. And Alito morphed all of this to like, you have to show that the minority group is voting in a way that can't be explained with just political preferences, because racism is gone in the United States, so people can just have different political beliefs. And there will never be a, I don't even know if anybody will bring a Section 2 challenge, let alone if any Section 2 challenge will survive a district court or an appellate court or make it to the Supreme Court. Like, it's just fucked. That is gone. And the microsecond that they got rid of that Section 2, I think is there a map of all the, what the districts are expected to look like? I'm hoping I was going to get an exaggerated map, but I think it's like every single district but one, I think, in the South right now, was gerrymandered to be Republican. And they did it instantly. They did it instantly. Sorry, there might be a few. I think I exaggerated. Oh, I wasn't counting Florida. Because, like, if you go south of, like, I don't think Orlando and south is, like, the south. That's, like, South Florida. That's not really, like, the south. They got it. They moved on this faster than a fly on dog shit. They moved instantly on this. And it's just, like, it's like you're in a classroom and it's, like, half black and half white. And one of the white kids, like, we should, you know what? We've banned racial slurs in this classroom. And, like, I don't really think that that's a motivating factor for white people not to say the N-word. We should just, like, get rid of this rule, guys. Like, come on, let's do it. And, like, okay, fuck it, let's do it. And then you get rid of it in, like, 2 seconds. Everybody's just screaming the N-word at the top of their lungs. The race-based gerrymandering is bad, but partisan gerrymandering seems just as bad, if not worse. Why the fuck are districts proportional to the ratio of partisan voters? The reality is that that's a tough, it's a tough question to ask, and it's an even a tougher issue to litigate, and it's tough to argue jurisdictionally, but it used to be, fuck, what was the case? I should remember the, if we were more serious, I would write down and we'd look up all the underlying cases too. I don't know if I, how much I give a fuck though, because reading Supreme Court decisions is the biggest waste of time. And I cannot imagine if you're some fucking cucked loser that studies con law or whatever, and you read through these decisions and you think you know anything at all about the law, and then the fucking magician Alito comes by with Robert's blessing to just totally write out of existence what you thought was supposed to be some fucking cornerstone of constitutional interpretation or whatever. You're just, but, The way that the Supreme Court looked at it was, this was their take, okay? I wish I could remember the specific case. I don't, it's not Allen. But basically what the Supreme Court said in the past was, racial gerrymandering is not okay. Partisan gerrymandering is like this, it's a disgusting and abhorrent thing, but we don't have the power federally to really ban it or to tell a state that they're not allowed to do it. Partisan gerrymandering is the prerogative of the state, right? The states get to decide who they want to send to the U.S. government to represent them in our federal courthouse, okay, or law, parliament, or whatever, Congress, right? The states get to decide that. If you want a partisan gerrymander, it's gross, it's disgusting, it's abhorrent. I think they might have even said it's against democracy or the principle of democracy, but that's on the, it's the purview of the states to do that, okay? In Alito's decision, he goes from looking at partisan gerrymandering as this, like, regretful thing that just might exist in some states to celebrating it. Well, you say it's racist, and I say, God bless him, it's partisan. And it's like, he's like enshrined partisan gerrymandering as this holier-than-thou concept. Oh, it might be Rucho. Rucho? The Common Cause is one that comes up a lot. Kagan talks about this a lot in her dissent. It's a really good dissent. If you want to understand the absurdity of that opinion, you should just read Kagan's dissent. I stand by the tweet that I made fucking 3 weeks ago. Anything like Thomas and Alito is stuff that you read when you want to hurt yourself. It's, oh my God, it's just insane. It's absolutely crazy how inspiring it should be that if these guys can be Supreme Court justices and you're wondering if you can be a lawyer, you can do it. You can absolutely do it, my friend. This decision, it did not. Callis just decided, says there must be evidence of racial motivation to find a violation of the VRA. You need proof of racial intent, not just disparate racial impact. Milligan had exactly that kind of evidence. Calla did not. So two are not in conflict. Yes, these are the types of people. If they say shit like this, they're either racist, they're partisan hacks, they're fucking retarded. They're most likely they're just partisan hacks. This is just not true. What Alito said very, very specifically, and there was a burden shift as well. There was a burden shift as well. What Alito said is, even if there is a disparate impact, even if it looks like it might have been racially done, not only, oh my God, oh, and I just remembered, he's not stupid. I keep saying they're stupid. You should have like a slap device, because I call so many of these people stupid and they're not. Alito was so smart. He's actually so smart. He's so much better than the one I said. Not only did Alito say, you have to prove that this was done racially, okay? And not just along partisan lines, which, by the way, is always going to be the case, because who the fuck would crack? We don't have black power and white power in our state legislatures. We have Republicans and Democrats. Who the fuck is going to gerrymander anything beyond partisan lines? The whole point of a gerrymander is to win seats. Who do you know that's so racist that they're like, those goddamn blacks
in Memphis. I think they're going to vote Republican, but we got to crack it anyway. We got to get these guys. We got to dilute that to some Democratic votes, okay? Because I think they're going to, but they're just so black, and I hate them because they're black. And even though they're going to vote for us, we got to get rid of them. We got to dilute it to Democratic votes. So every partisan is definitionally going to be gerrymandered. You partisan a district based on the electoral outcomes. That's what you're partisaning. That's what you're dividing it for. That's the whole point, is who they vote for. But Alito said, not only do you have to prove, okay, that they were giggling and emailing N-words back and forth to each other, you have to provide a map that satisfies every single condition that was non-racial that the state was trying to satisfy anyway. So even if you can prove it, you have to give them a map that does the exact same partisan shit, which is the only reason you would ever gerrymander in the first place. It's crazy. Okay, that's okay. I don't care, though. Who cares? It's a shitty law anyway, I guess, right? Thank God. One of the nice things about the Supreme Court is you don't need Congress to do anything. The Supreme Court can just whisper to God and say he doesn't like that law. It's gone. It's gonzo garbanzo. It's gonzo garbanzo because the Supreme Court said it. Yes, kings. This goes directly to your point on process when talking with Hutch. Yeah, but the problem is nobody, I don't even blame Hutch for this. I really don't, okay? I like to read stuff and research stuff because I'm autistic. I like the whole rules shit and everything is fun for me, okay? I grew up playing text games. It's fun. I understand it. It's very, very hard if you don't. Also, keep in mind that the legal knowledge that I have is like 1% of like the depth of all legal knowledge. So it's not like I'm fucking scholarly at this, right? Just I read a few things, okay? But if you have any kind of understanding of how the law works, okay, you would understand that you can get any outcome you want with a strict reading of anything. Okay, that is why that is a bedrock principle of law, is that you can do anything with it. You know why? Because, or the reason why we know this is because we have judges. The whole reason why we have a judicial system is because we need people to make judgments and interpretations on legal matters. Okay, you don't have like a compiler for code where you have a second compiler that makes sure the first compiler compiled it correctly or whatever, right? It just does what it does. There is no interpretation on, you know, whatever bullshit. It just does it. It's a thing, and then it translates to another thing, and it's reversible, one-to-one, that's it, okay? That's it. But law is complicated. You've got humans, you've got language, you've got there's just so much going on. And if you truly have a bad faith actor, you can read anything as anything. If you really want, you can read however you want. But when I say that, I think that people are, they think I'm either exaggerating, or they think I'm ignorant, or they think it can't possibly be that stupid. That would be crazy. And for those people, I just invite them to read the 47 pages of that Virginia Supreme Court decision. You should just read it. It'll blow your mind. It'll blow your mind that you might go in thinking like, man, how much law am I going to have to read to understand this? And then it's a bunch of people arguing back and forth what Merriam-Webster says a day is. And that's what that case came down to. In the majority opinion of the dissent in the Virginia case, fucking retards, they try to argue law or inconsistency or having a harmonious constitution, whatever bullshit, doesn't matter, retards, okay? Because the majority, they have the dictionary on their side and their skewed, narrow reading that fits whatever they, in that particular moment, wanted to fit. Which justice is bad faith? Thomas and Alito gotta go. They are certified fucking retards. Roberts should go because I think that at some point there has to be a medical disability that makes it so that you can't be, what is it, C3 to C5, keep you alive or whatever? This guy has no vertebrae at all, and somehow he's still writing opinions. After seeing that shadow docket shit, I don't even know. I don't even know. Thomas and Alito gotta go. These guys are retarded. It can't be that you have 9 members on a Supreme Court and you get 2 freebies every decision. That's crazy bullshit. You can't have 2 freebies when there's 9 points. That's bullshit, okay? Explain the shadow docket shit. It's basically does the shadow docket only apply to pleading stage things? Basically, if you're on a low-level court, it goes district, appeals, Supreme Court, okay? So district courts, so when you hear like Southern District of New York, whatever district or whatever, almost always these are federal courts, district courts, and then you have your appeals court. You might hear them called the appellate courts. These are your circuit courts. Every time you hear circuit court, that's your first court of appeal from a district court, okay? So federal, all these are federal courts, okay? So your district court, your appellate courts, your Supreme Court.
sometimes the Supreme Court is allowed to go down to a district court, somebody in a district court can appeal directly to the Supreme Court, and a single member on the Supreme Court can look at some of these decisions, and they can make these, I don't know, would these be considered interlocutory appeals? Basically, they can enjoin, or they can stay, or they can make these preliminary rulings on these lower cases before the cases have even made their way up properly to the Supreme Court. And I think there's a world where somebody in chat said, Destiny, the shadow docket is a completely normal procedure that libs are brain broken about. I literally voted for Kamala, but the hysteria around that is unfounded. I think that there's a world where maybe shadow docket stuff is okay, but the problem is that it seems like what it's become is an incredibly partisan tool for justices to make rulings, really early rulings, about cases that haven't even really gotten up to them yet, that they probably shouldn't have a say over, in cases that like clearly aren't an emergency, is the issue. So like the shadow docket stuff that was leaked on the New York Times basically had to do with an EPA rule that was going through, okay? So in our body of things, okay, remember, all right, I repeat this stuff for you guys just as much as for me, okay? You have the Constitution, and that makes for Congress, and then Congress can pass laws, all right, or statutes, if you wish. And then from there, we have the president / the executive who executes the laws, and one of the ways that they execute the laws is through rules, okay? So if you see something say this is a federal rule, a rule, okay, that's not a law, that's the executive carrying out the law, okay? So the Constitution, okay, gives the power to Congress to create statutes or laws that the executive will interpret how it will, and it'll create rules from those laws, okay? So there was a new EPA rule that was going into effect, and some people were suing the executive, they were suing the United States saying, we don't believe that the reading of this rule is fair. You're forcing us to change something in a way that we don't think is okay. And what happened was while that case was going on, I don't even know if there was an appeal or not, but Roberts basically decided that this case that's happening right now, I think that these guys are making a good point. I think that there's a risk of irreparable harm if this rule goes through too fast. We're going to go ahead and we're going to issue, I think it would be an injunction, right? It wouldn't be a stay on a government. I think they enjoined the government from carrying out that rule. The rationale was, the bad part was the rationale was crazy. Oh, fuck, you have to dive into so many different topics. But the rationale that Roberts used here was dog shit. How do you pronounce the guy's name? Is it Bayer or Breyer? Stephen Breyer wrote a response and he was like, Roberts, I think that you're kind of fucking retarded here, bro. Maybe we should just do this. Wouldn't this make way more sense? I think most of the other people agreed. I think Alito or somebody came out and slurped up some shit. And then there was one other justice whose name I don't remember who slurped up some shit. And then the Supreme Court shut down this federal rule out of nowhere. And then it basically remained shut down for like 3 or 4 years. And then I think by the time it even got to the Supreme Court, eventually when they go to rule on like this new case in front of the Supreme Court, they go to rule on the prior rule that they'd already enjoined the government again. And then it was just bullshit. All of this procedurally is just fucking is whack. Oh, is it? Oh, wait, it's Michael Breyer. It's not Stephen Breyer. What Supreme Court justice was Stephen something? Who am I thinking of? Or is it Stephen Bayer? Can another justice overrule or revoke the shadow docket ruling of another? So I believe that the way that it works is that one justice is allowed to issue a preliminary ruling based on a shadow docket thing. If the justice wants, though, they can submit it to the rest of the court, I think, for a ruling on it, I believe. This professor wrote the paper arguing that Trump was banned from office under the 14th Amendment. He just wrote a short explanation of the shadow docket. What a bunch of what a waste of time reading anything from this guy. Baud? This guy, number one fucking loser, actual fucking clown. I wasted my fucking time reading him and another law professor, Paulson, wrote this like 120-page paper on why Trump should be banned based on the 14th Amendment. But they didn't spend any time in their paper considering how inconvenient it would be, which was what the Supreme Court decision boiled down to. It would be really inconvenient. So the Supreme Court wiped away Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They were like, fuck this, actually. It would be really inconvenient to do this. I'm not joking and I'm not exaggerating. That was their chief rationale. I'm sorry, that guy's not stupid. I'm being sarcastic. I don't want to read it, though. I don't care. Fuck everything. He sees Sotomayor comparing current situation to 1930s Germany. Is that comment out of line for SCOTUS justice? No, because, someday we'll go back to the Nazi shit. Although maybe we won't have to. We'll just relive it. Germany was fractured And Hitler had to do a lot of work to bring together like different parties and to gain power in parliament, to subvert like the majority. And they had to do all this wacky, weird shit. The Supreme Court is doing wacky and weird shit, but they're doing it with a majority elected president. That's the big difference, is that Donald Trump won the election as much as you can win it fair and square. So like, it's the amount of hoops that he has to jump through are so much less. That's why I don't like to compare. It's so much worse than the Nazi shit, because he has so much popular authority granted to him. Sorry, not the parliament, the Reichstag. Reichstag. So you're saying Supreme Court decisions were basically vibes? Yes, it was. It is. They are. They are all vibes. This is why I completely and utterly reject, don't trigger me, the originalism, textualism, whatever. Okay, I'm sorry. Hold on. So Smashter in KickChat says, it's not that they wiped away Section 3. It's that Congress could make the law to call those that would try to deny the election results and lead a violent mob would be considered as insurrectionists. But I can understand your point that Congress is too weak to push said law and pass it. Okay. So remember the little thing that I drew earlier, okay? The Constitution or whatever comes first, all right? The Constitution is the document that grants power to the government and foundationally serves as like the bedrock of everything that exists as part of our government. You do not need to write laws to say that's what is in the Constitution is in the Constitution, okay? The term you would look for would be self-executing. If it's in the Constitution, that's it. It's law. Now, however, oh God, you triggered the fuck out of me. Sometimes for these early amendments, they did write, you are correct, they wrote, the Congress shall have power to enforce, by appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article. So if Congress wanted to, they could write an additional law to support some of the things in this amendment, but that doesn't mean they need to. That doesn't mean that this section is not in effect unless Congress writes a law for it. That's what this language means. And you know how I know that? Do you know how I know that the what's in the amendment is true and real, and you don't need a law necessarily to enforce it? You know, I know that because that's what Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was. And Alito used the exact opposite argument when he didn't like Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. He said, well, there's actually tension between the law, the appropriate legislation. There's actually some tension between that and Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. We don't think Congress should have been allowed to write that law. So when it comes to presidential immunity, whoa, we need a law to enforce Section 3. By the way, no, you fucking don't. Show me that anywhere in here. It's not in here. It's not. There's not a single place here that says this isn't in effect unless Congress writes a law for it. That's not true. Okay? But when Congress does write laws to enforce things in the Constitution, 14th and 15th Amendment, Alito says, well, actually, why do we need that law? Let's just look at the 14th and 15th Amendment. That's why it's all vibes and it's all bullshit. It's all vibes and it's all bullshit and it's all vibes and it's all bullshit. Okay? It's all vibes and it's all bullshit. They'll use whatever fucking argument they want. And at the end of the day, the strongest argument they had in this case was that it would be mighty inconvenient for states to selectively ban presidents from the ballot. Okay? Sorry, I'm not trying to shout at you in particular. You are right that that's the argument he used, but you don't have to pass a law. The language is plain. Remember, rule number one for constitutional interpretation, okay? For all legal interpretation, I believe. When the text is clear and unambiguous, you follow the text. Full stop. When the text is clear and unambiguous, you follow the text. That's it. But it doesn't matter. What if you don't like the text, though? Then you don't do it. 20 pages, by the way, to axe this part of the... I think even Amy wrote that, I feel like you guys kind of went kind of far here, right? Was this the one where she did? Or I could be thinking of the immunity case, actually. Oh, yeah, no, that's right. Because in this one, props to Kagan, props to Sotomayor, props to Jackson. They realized how important it was for us to come together as Americans and come all over the Constitution collectively. Thank God. This was a 9-0 per curiam. Every justice came together and realized how important it was to avoid the mighty inconvenience. Anybody remember the... Oh, my God. Anybody remember the word they used? Remember, what do conservatives think about federalism? Ugh, federal government. Ugh, states' rights. Yes, every state has its own constitution, its own executor, its own legislature. That's so fucking awesome that we can have this beautiful quilt of a nation. But what do we call it when Section 3 might be kind of... Well, now it's a patchwork. Oh my God, we're not going to have we're not going to have a complete and total congruence in every single state on this particular issue that would keep Daddy Trump out of office? Today, the court departs from that vital principle, deciding not just this case, but challenges that might arise in the future. In this case, the court must decide whether Colorado may keep a presidential candidate off the ballot on the ground that he is an oath-breaking insurrectionist and thus disqualified from holding federal office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Allowing Colorado to do so would, we agree, create a chaotic state-by-state patchwork at odds with our nation's federalism principles. Oh my God. Yes. Oh, federal. Yeah, true. It's just such a joke, bro. None of this matters. Don't even waste your time on any of this shit. It's all retarded anyway. This is literally all retarded shit. Last line of Section 3 is even more explicit, saying for it to not apply, Congress would have to vote on it. Why would that be if it wasn't in effect to begin with? Every single time you think that the Constitution will protect you, you should just think of Game of Thrones. He just
protector
handed her,
of the realm.
That's the U.S. Constitution. Look, this is Alito right here. Lib cucks. This guy's a lib cuck. That's why he's limping.
Is this meant to be your shield, Lord Stark?
Lemeo. Why do I care about this guy? He can't even... Let me listen for an accent to see if this guy's even going to be able to vote in the United States in 10 years.
The Supreme Court is corrupt. You might hear that and think, well...
Ah, fuck. He sounds like he might be in a state where he can still vote. We'll get to that. We'll change that. Don't worry. We'll get these guys out of here.
Jamel, you just disagree with the rulings. They're not corrupt. They're doing their jobs. But I want to posit to you that they're not doing their jobs. They're, in fact, doing something very different. They're acting as a super legislature, an unelected group of people who have taken it upon themselves to correct Congress, not when Congress has overstepped its bounds, not when Congress has overstepped its powers, but when the court simply doesn't like what they're doing. Typically, when we use the word corruption, we are thinking about monetary corruption, bribes, and the like. And it should be said there's some of this. Clarence Thomas, in particular, is known for taking large sums, large gifts, from his wealthy benefactors. Sam Alito has also been the beneficiary of wealthy friends. So there is that kind of corruption as well. But corruption also has a broader meaning. It can mean the malign use of power, the substitution of the public trust for your own private will, your own private interests. And that is, more than anything else, what is happening with the Supreme Court. You can see it in many different ways. The Roberts Court is quite fond of simply ignoring the plain text of the Constitution whenever it gets into the way of their particular political and ideological projects. The Roberts Court wants to do a few things. It wants to gut the Reconstruction Amendments. It wants to aggrandize presidential power. It wants to free corporate speech. It wants to allow the wealthy to interact with the political system in any way they choose. And it wants to pursue the particular partisan interests of the Republican Party. And so when the text of the Constitution gets in the way, they change the text or they ignore it. The text of the Constitution clearly gives Congress the power to handle racial discrimination in voting. And when it came up to the court in 2013 in Shelby County, the court simply made up a new doctrine, state sovereignty, all states have to be treated equally, in order to undermine a provision that subjected states with histories of voting discrimination to stricter scrutiny by the federal government. When the court wanted to protect its special boy, Donald Trump.
Why is textualism bad? Why should we not read the Constitution as what the writers meant? Or do I misunderstand what textualism is? This might just be my upbringing. And maybe you get so brain broken as a child, you can actually never truly break away from it. And all of us are just our parents' upbringing. I think that, like, spiritually, I might be a conservative, maybe, like, deep, deep, deep down. But just the way that it's applied in so many different ways is kind of like, it just ends up being more left. Based on what I've seen, based on how I hear people describe things like textualism, that seems to be, in my opinion, how you should read the Constitution. That things are written in a certain way, in a certain time and place, and that's how you read it. And there might be times in the future where that reading will come into conflict with how we want our government, or more fundamentally, our Constitution, to function. And in those cases, I'm sorry, that might not be textualism. I'm sorry, that's originalism. My bad. Originalism. In those cases, and you amend the Constitution, right? The issue, though, is that it feels like people will wield these terms or descriptors for how they view the Constitution incredibly selectively, which means that that's not what they feel at all. There's something else going on there, which is like the annoying... Hold on, I need to look this up real quick. Textualism versus originalism.
But more intellectually, I would call myself an originalist. I personally don't draw a distinction between originalism and textualism.
Oh, well, fuck you, Chatter.
I think if you wanted to nitpick, you could say originalism is textualism applied to the Constitution. But both start from the premise that words have meanings, and those meanings are fixed when they're written down, and they don't evolve over time. And that's true whether you're reading a constitution or a cookbook or Shakespeare or a poem or anything else. I suppose the reason I'm an originalist is I think that's how language works. And if we don't have fixed meaning, then in my view, we don't in any meaningful sense have a constitution.
I don't know how smart this guy is or not. I agree what he's saying, but I would say the rationale is the opposite. That's not how language works, which is why it's important, I think, to be an originalist. Language does change and evolve over time. So the reason why we have to read things in their original language is to figure out what was meant when it was written, right? That's why. When people originally talked about how all men were created equal, we talked about mankind, even though women didn't have equal rights, they did mean all people, right? They did, well, except for blacks, maybe. But they did, generally speaking, at least for us white folk, okay? They meant people. They didn't just mean men, and everybody else was not created by God or whatever. Because language changed over time, yeah. Sometimes you have to go back and you have to try to understand what they meant at the time of a thing, yeah. Textualism interprets statutes based on the ordinary meaning of the words at the time they were written, ignoring legislative history or intent. Originalism interprets the Constitution based on what it meant to the public at the time it was adopted. So, like, I don't think I want to get into this. I don't know if... I think that legislative... Well, I don't know. Legislative history, I think, can be part of textualism. If the... this is such a niche. Never mind. I don't care. All right. By these definitions, textualism seems retarded. Like, if a word gets redefined, then can we completely ignore what a law originally meant? Well, no. You're supposed to go back and read, like, how it was originally used, right? The problem, though, and you saw this a lot, arguably, this was at its peak... I say at its peak, and I've read like 7 Supreme Court cases, okay, so take what I say with a grain of salt. But I think one of the peak things that you see, this is in Dobbs. One of the issues when it comes to like interpreting the text is that when you're trying to interpret the text, right, there's 3 things. I asked this before and I forget it. But the first is like when the text is clear and unambiguous, you follow the text. And then I think the second one is if there's some ambiguities, then you look to the history. And then there's a third one. For the tradition? Is the tradition the third one? But let's say that there's like a word in the Constitution, and the Constitution says, on Fridays, no man shall slurberborp, okay? Well, and let's say that as time goes on, you know, we actually don't know what this means anymore. What is a slurberborp, right? Well, you wouldn't look to what it means right now. You would go to the past, and you would find out, well, when they said slurberborp, what were the people that were framing this amendment or part of the Constitution? What did they say about the word? But the issue that you run into there is now you're debating and arguing over the strength and authenticity of historical documents. So now everybody gets to dig through the record and try to make what they believe is their strongest argument. Well, when the framers on the slurber borper burper side, when they said that it meant this, this is what all they said. And it's like, well, on the slurber burper flyper side, they said the exact opposite, what they meant. And then it's an argument between the two. And in Dobbs, you had, I think, a decent amount of like, well, what did it mean when a woman was in her quickening, and what were the laws meant as applied in these different states to figure out what people believed at the time? And it's this picking back and forth of like, who's got the correct interpretation? What did this law actually mean? What was this constitutional thing trying to get at when they implemented it? And that can be a clusterfuck of shit. A textualist would believe you could accidentally adopt a right you didn't mean to because you used broad wording, whereas an originalist would only look at intent, a la Gorsuch and trans and Indian. Oh, maybe. Is that only as applied to the Constitution, or could that be applied to congressional statutes as well and federal rules? Because that could be it. Because a textualist might say something like you pass like civil rights and black people can vote, and then like black people want to get married to white women, or black women want to get married to white men, or whatever the fuck, however you want to do that. And then somebody would look at this and go, well, hold on, our Constitution said that... only a man and a woman could marry. And at the time, we thought that man just meant white man. And maybe a textualist would say, well, they wrote the word man, and man technically means all males. So actually, I guess all males can marry all women, and all women can marry all males. So there you go. Maybe a textualist would say that. Even if the intent was different at the time, it doesn't matter because of the language. I don't know. The reality is, don't worry about any of this. None of it matters. Every judge writes whatever the fuck they want for whatever outcome they want to achieve anyway. So.
From criminal
Trump just fired the FDA chief. Based?
Prosecution, it invented a doctrine of criminal immunity for core duties, found nowhere in the Constitution and frankly contradicted by the text, history, and theory behind the Constitution. More recently, rather than just shutting down Trump's efforts to unravel birthright citizenship, the court has taken them seriously despite the clear text and history of the 14th Amendment. Where the text interferes with partisan political goals, this Supreme Court says, to hell with the text. The other manner in which the court demonstrates corruption is by not having any particularly consistent jurisprudence. Despite grand claims of being originalist or textualist, this court often decides not based on any particular theory of jurisprudence, but simply on whether they have a decided interest in the case in question, a partisan or political interest. Consider 2 days in 2022, back to back.
I hated that I read this. I think because it gave me a biased view of liking Gorsuch too much. We're going to read this, okay? God, what a fucking retard. God, I can't believe they waste pages on this. Look at this fucking moron. He's so cracked out of his fucking mind. Usually he can only write like 2 or 3 fucking pages of a concurrence. And it's always on some like irrelevant bullshit. It'll be some shit like, oh, Sam, fuck you or whatever. Like, I see you down there, bitch. And he just like cranks out like the most retarded fucking shit in the universe. Or it's to signal to some other fucking guy. I hate him so much. I hate Thomas Martin Alito. Okay. All right. Sorry. Okay, you hear me jerk this guy off a lot, and literally the only reason why is because of because I read this concurrence here. Okay, I've heard this 2 ways, stare decisis and stare decisis. Let me just hear it said. How do they say it? I bring up this concept a lot, and it's important, I think, to understand it. And Gorsuch writes very beautifully about it here. I think it epitomizes a lot of my issues with, or emblematic of a lot of my issues with this recent case. Chevron deference, we don't have to get into this case, but there was a Supreme Court case a long time ago. It was kind of a cornerstone of business law. And basically what it said was that, not business law, what would you say it? Like federal business shit or whatever? I don't know. I don't care. For a long time, if the Congress wrote a law, admin law, okay. The Congress wrote a law. Remember, we've got to interpret everything as we're doing everything, because it's language, okay? Despite how fucking retarded every single other person besides me, I'm the only one that's being honest, okay? Besides what everyone else says, language is all feels. It's all interpretations. It's all like, you know, I'm smattering a bunch of sounds out, and I'm hoping that I'm doing my best to convey some idea to you, okay? And hopefully it's like where there's parity between the 2 ideas now that exist in our heads, okay? But it's always going to be imprecise, because I can't hook my brain up to yours until Neuralink becomes more powerful, all right? So the Supreme Court is our interpreter of the Constitution. If they think that a congressional statute is in conflict with what's in the Constitution, okay? But remember, congressional statutes are just laws, all right? It's up to the executive branch, okay? The president has to enforce those laws, and oftentimes they do this through a rulemaking process. So the federal government will make rules, federal rules, that get their power from, they're based off of, the congressional laws, okay? What Chevron deference was a long time ago when the federal government made a rule, if somebody were to challenge that rule in court, and they would go, hey, we're saying that that rule that the federal government made, it doesn't comply with the law, the EPA, the whoever, they're going way, way, way out of their bounds. Congress didn't give them the authority to do that. What the Supreme Court would do if they had to evaluate a case like that is it was called Chevron deference. Basically, they would look at it and they would say, in essence, there was a 2-step thing, but fuck all that. They would just say, is the government reading this in a way that we think is permissible, right? Is it permissible? And as long as it is, then you're basically good to go, okay? The Supreme Court, because they like to have all the cards and they like to do everything, basically changed their mind on Chevron, and they said, well, actually, reading laws correctly, that's kind of our thing, and fuck the federal government. There's only one correct way to read a congressional statute, and it's what we say, okay? So everything that received this Chevron deference before, fuck that, okay? We're the ones who have the final say, and the only say. There are not multiple permissible readings of a congressional statute that a federal rule can be derived from. There's only one correct reading. And statutory construction, okay, which I think refers to the idea of like taking a statute and then construing, you know, what you're allowed to do with it, that is strictly and exclusively in the purview of the Supreme Court, okay? So fuck the federal government, okay? Anyway, so they're overturning Chevron. So as a large part of his concurrence, Gorsuch writes on this concept of stare decisis, all right, which is, well, what is this? Okay. Turning now directly to the question, what stare decisis effect Chevron deference warrants, each of these lessons seems to me to weigh firmly in favor of the course. Oh, no, wait. Sorry, hold on. Wait. I skipped that. He just writes about it in section 1, I think. Wait. My bad. Oh, okay. Much shorter. Okay. That's just him explaining this concept. Okay. Where does he start with this? Yeah, fuck it. You know what? What the fuck else do you have to do today? Today, the phrase common law judge may call to mind a judicial titan of the past who brilliantly devised new legal rules on his own. The phrase stare decisis might conjure up a sense that judges who come later in time are strictly bound to follow the work of their predecessors. But neither of those intuitions fairly describes the traditional common law understanding of the judge's role or the doctrine of stare decisis. At common law, a judge's charge to decide cases was not usually understood as a license to make new law.
For much of England's early history, different rulers and different legal systems prevailed in different regions. As England consolidated into a single kingdom governed by a single legal system, the judge's task was to examine those pre-existing legal traditions and apply in the disputes that came to him those legal rules that were common to the whole land and to all Englishmen. That was common law judging. This view of the judge's role had consequences for the authority due judicial decisions. Because a judge's job was to find and apply the law, not make it, the opinion of the judge and the law were not considered one and the same thing. A judge's decision might bind the parties to the case at hand, but none of that meant the judge had the power to make a law properly so called for society at large, for that only the king and parliament can do. Other consequences followed for the role precedent played in future judicial proceedings. Because past decisions represented something less than a law, they did not bind future judges. At the same time, as Matthew Hale put it, a future judge could give a past decision weight as evidence of the law. Expressing the same idea, William Blackstone conceived of judicial precedents as evidence of the common law. And much like other forms of evidence, precedents at common law were thought to vary in the weight due them. Some past decisions might supply future courts with considerable guidance, but others might be entitled to lesser weight, not least because judges are no less prone to error than anyone else, and they may sometimes mistake what the law demands. In cases like that, both men thought, a future judge should not rotely repeat a past mistake, but instead vindicate the law from misrepresentation. This is plain enough English? I don't have to interpret this, right? When examining past decisions as evidence of the law, common law judges did not, broadly speaking, afford overwhelming weight to any single precedent. Instead, a prior decision's persuasive force depended in large measure on its consonancy and congruity with resolutions and decisions of former times. An individual decision might reflect the views of one court at one moment in time, but a consistent line of decisions representing the wisdom of many minds across many generations was generally considered stronger evidence of the law's meaning. Consonance meaning like how much in harmony is this with all of the rest of our understanding of the laws and the surrounding laws, and then congruity meaning how much is it said to be the same over and over and over again, right? With this conception of precedent in mind, Lord Mansfield cautioned against elevating particular cases above the general principles that run through the cases and govern the decision of them. By discarding aberrational rulings and pursuing instead the mainstream of past decisions, he observed, the common law tended over time to work itself pure. So you wouldn't just pick one crazy wacky decision and say, well, this is what we should base everything off of. You would look to the general rule over time, the consonance and contiguity of all the decisions over time, knowing that there might be a few aberrant decisions every now and then. Reflecting similar thinking, Edmund Burke offered five principles for the evaluation of past judicial decisions. They ought to be shewn, first, to be numerous and not scattered here and there. Secondly, concurrent and not contradictory and mutually destructive. Thirdly, to be made in good and constitutional times. Fourthly, not to be made to serve an occasion. And fifthly, to be agreeable to the general tenor of legal principles. I would explain these, but he's going to get into all five of these going down below. Okay. Not only did different decisions carry different weight, so did different language within a decision. An opinion's holding and the reasoning essential to it, the ratio decidendi, merited careful attention. Dicta, stray remarks, and digressions warranted less weight. Dicta is basically, you know, like, judge, I'm asking you, do you think this law means that the color blue is the prettiest color? And the judge is like, I'm looking at this law and I do indeed see that the color blue is the prettiest color. And that's because I love butterflies so much and they flap their wings and they're beautiful. If a future judge were to cite to that particular holding the court's opinion on that, if you were citing to the judge saying that the color blue is the best and all that, that would be considered, that's the holding. Dicta would be like the judge saying he has a favorite butterfly. That's not part of the holding of the case. That's not what the court was asked to look at. That's not part of the major ruling. It's dicta. It's just random stray remarks, you might say, right? These were no more than vapors and fumes of law. That is not to say that those vapors were worthless. often dicta might provide the parties to a particular dispute a fuller understanding of the court's decisional path or related areas of concern. Dicta might also provide future courts with a source of thoughtful advice, but future courts had to be careful not to treat every hasty expression as a serious and deliberate opinion. To do so would work an injustice to the memory of their predecessors, who could not expect judicial remarks issued in one context to apply perfectly in others, perhaps especially ones they could not foresee. So, for instance, quoting the Nixon v. Fitzgerald case that had to do with whether or not the president could be held or the administration could be held civilly liable to be sued because people were being fired from the government, one might say that it would be incredibly inappropriate for the court to quote that case and to quote that court with regards to criminal immunity in the that was Trump v. USA, right? In that case, right? That would be inappropriate. And actually, we're not even talking about dicta. That was holding the case, but it didn't even apply. But whatever. Sorry. Anyway, that was a bad example because that actually wasn't dicta. That was just that was the holding of a case that shouldn't have even been that relevant. But don't worry. Forget I said that. Also, the limits of the adversarial process, a distinctive feature of English law, had to be borne in mind. When a single judge or a small panel reached a decision in a case, they did so based on the factual record and legal arguments the parties at hand have chosen to develop. Attuned to those constraints, future judges had to proceed with an open mind to the possibility that different facts and different legal arguments might dictate different outcomes in later disputes. This is important because when you argue about like the percolation of different courts, when you have cases that get up to the Supreme Court, ideally what you want is you want like a richly developed factual record with many different courts trying these arguments, with many different judges ruling, with a different factual record in front of the judges before it makes its way up to your circuit courts and then maybe ultimately to the Supreme Court. You don't really want the Supreme Court making a huge ruling that's going to have far-reaching impacts on a single case with only a single factual record before it and without like the consideration of plenty of other judges. Typically, I think we would generally consider that to be bad practice, right? Necessarily, this represents just a quick sketch of traditional common law understandings of the judge's role and the place of precedent in it. It focuses, too, on the horizontal, not vertical, force of judicial precedence. But there are good reasons to think that the common law's understandings of judges and precedent outlined above crossed the Atlantic and informed the nature of the judicial power the Constitution vests in federal courts, Article 3, Section 1. Not only was the Constitution adopted against the backdrop of these understandings, and in light of that alone, they may provide evidence of what the framers meant when they spoke of the judicial power, many other, more specific provisions of the Constitution reflect much the same distinction between law-making and law-finding functions the common law did. The Constitution provides that its terms may be amended only through certain prescribed democratic processes. Article 5. It vests the power to enact federal legislation exclusively in the people's elected representatives in Congress. For Article 1, Section 1. Meanwhile, the Constitution describes the judicial power of the power as the power to resolve cases and controversies. Article 3, Section 2. Clause 1. As well, it delegates that authority to life tenure judges. See Section 1, as an assignment that would have made little sense if judges could usurp lawmaking powers vested in periodically elected representatives. But one that makes perfect sense, if what is sought is a neutral party to interpret and apply the law without fear or favor in a dispute between others. Obviously, just talking about the different roles of like, the, you know, judges are just here to resolve disputes. They're not here to create law. This is how we understand it. The constrained view of the judicial power that runs through our Constitution carries with it familiar implications, ones the framers readily acknowledged. James Madison, for example, proclaimed that it would be a fallacy to suggest that judges or their precedents could repeal or alter the Constitution or the laws of the United States. A court's opinion, James Wilson added, may be thought of as effective law as to the parties. But as in England, Wilson said, a prior judicial decision could serve in a future dispute only as evidence of the law's proper construction, meaning how you would interpret said law and apply said law. The framers also recognized that the judicial power described in our Constitution implies, as the judicial power did in England, a power and duty of discrimination when it comes to assessing the evidence embodied in past decisions. So, for example, Madison observed that judicial rulings repeatedly confirmed may supply better evidence of the law's meaning than isolated or aberrant ones. Extending the thought, Thomas Jefferson believed that it would often take numerous decisions for the meaning of new statutes to become truly settled. From the start, too, American courts recognized that not everything found in a prior decision was entitled to equal weight. As Chief Justice Marshall warned, it is a maxim not to be disregarded that general expressions in every opinion are to be taken in connection with the case in which those expressions are used. To the extent a past court offered views beyond the case, those expressions may be respected in a later case, but ought not to control the judgment. One obvious reason for this, Marshall continued, had to do with the limits of the adversarial process we inherited from England. Only the question actually before the court is investigated with care and considered in its full extent. Other principles, which may serve to illustrate it, are considered in their relation to the case decided, but their possible bearing on all other cases is seldom completely investigated. So this concept is like you're putting an important issue before the court. That's what the court has to decide. You want to be careful about them making comments on other things, right? If you want to, for a real life example of this, one of the annoying things about Pixie and her little fucking family court trying to pedo jacket me is the question about this other person that I was being catfished with is never going to be a factual dispute before this court because it's not really what our case is about. So for the plaintiff to throw this into court filings and then to ask the judge to make rulings on it or whatever is not really proper because the court is not being tasked with actually evaluating this particular question. And then that would apply to any case, basically. There's going to be a particular question before the court. That's what the two people, the two adversarial parties, the plaintiff and the defense, that's what they're going to be fighting for beneath them. The litigants below you might not be developing a record or making arguments with other stuff not related to the case. You don't really want the judges to say random shit that's not like in front of them, basically, right? Abraham Lincoln championed these traditional understandings in his debates with Stephen Douglas. Douglas took the view that a single decision of this court, no matter how flawed, could definitively resolve a contested issue for everyone and all time. Those who thought otherwise, he said, aimed a deadly blow to our whole Republican system of government. But Lincoln knew better. While accepting that judicial decisions absolutely determine the rights of the parties to a court's judgment, he refused to accept that any single judicial decision could fully settle an issue, particularly when that decision departs from the Constitution. In cases such as these, Lincoln explained, it is not resistance. It is not factious. It is not even disrespectful to treat the decision as not having yet quite established a settled doctrine for the country. Skipping down here to this. From all this, I see at least three lessons about the doctrine of stare decisis relevant to the decision before us today. Each concerns a form of judicial humility. First, a past decision may bind the parties to a dispute, but it provides this court no authority in future cases to depart from what the Constitution or laws of the United States ordain. Instead, the Constitution promises the American people are sovereign and they alone may, through democratically responsive processes, amend our foundational charter or revise federal legislation. I think the second part here is another lesson tempers the first. While judicial decisions may not supersede or revise the Constitution or federal statutory law, they merit our respect as embodying the considered views of those who have come before. And then the third point down here is it would be a mistake to read judicial opinions like statutes adopted through a robust and democratic process. Statutes often apply in all their particulars to all persons. By contrast, when judges reach a decision in our adversarial system, they render a judgment based only on the factual record and legal arguments the parties at hand have chosen to develop. You can read the rest of it, but to summarize, basically, he gives a good summary of like what stare decisis is, and then he makes the argument for why it's important and these different kind of like rules for why you have like stare decisis as it goes on over time, that you respect these past decisions made by the courts, they're given due deference and weight for these reasons, and all of this to say that when you go, the Voting Rights Act decision that Alito made, you had a court that had interpreted the Voting Rights Act in one way, the people of America and the Congress did not like the way that the Supreme Court interpreted the Voting Rights Act then in accordance with the Constitution. So the people of the United States, through our Congress, modified Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in order to strengthen it against what they saw as a bad interpretation. And then they included language from that past Supreme Court decision. They incorporated that same language into Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act going forward. So they passed a law to bring it in harmony with what the Supreme Court would have said, to make it constitutional. And then that harmony between the statute and the courts persisted for 37 years. This is like your strongest version of, what you would want law to be. So for Alito to come by and just turn all of this, it just fucking triggers the fuck out of me. Okay, sorry. Okay, we went down a rabbit hole here.
The first of those days, the court held that because you cannot find gun regulation in the annals of American history, therefore, there's no history or tradition supporting New York State's attempt to regulate individual gun ownership. And then the very next day, the court releases an opinion stating that despite the fact that you cannot find very much evidence of abortion...
Fun fact, the director of the movie 300 said that he modeled the efforts that Leonidas meets to receive their blessing for war after the Supreme Court of the United States describing them as vibe-based. Okay. Do you think a judgment of the Federalist Society is going to let anything get in the way of ruling in favor of conservatives? It's all just team sports, baby. True! I think it's still possible to save the VRA by having the next update include a ban on partisan gerrymandering as well. Yeah, but the Republicans will never go for that. And why would they? Oh, that's true. That's what I should remember these cases. The 1982 amendment to the Voting Rights Act for Section 2 included wording from the White case because they didn't like what came from the Bolden case. You're right.
So what is there to be done about the court? There's a real chance that Democrats will have a trifecta in 2029. They might even have large majorities. And in that environment, court reform must be table stakes. There's no other choice, no other option. The rest of the agenda is simply not possible without court reform. The usual proposals for court reform are expanding the court, and I think that should be done. Expand the court, expand the entire federal judiciary, expand the number of circuits, expand the number of justices commensurate with the circuits. But I think there's much more to be done than just court expansion. Because it's not simply that the court is not on the right side, it's that the court is too powerful. It's concentrated too much power in itself, and we have to deal with the concentration of power. So court reform legislation has to be geared towards reducing the court's power. One of those tools would be what's called jurisdiction stripping, which is permitted under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. Congress should say that the court simply cannot adjudicate these particular issues. The Congress should impose ethics reform on the court, and it should put sharp limits on justices' ability to get book deals, go on tours, collect honorariums. But that's all small ball stuff. There are more radical options as well. We're going to talk about those. More radical options that really would break up the power of the court and cut the court back down to size to remind it that it doesn't stand above the entire American system as a council of kings, that is very much part of the American system in dialogue with the other branches and accountable to the people. So we can turn the Supreme Court's neoclassical building, first and foremost, into a museum of some sort. And the court will return to its original place, the basement of Congress. Hell, maybe even an office park in Northern Virginia. I don't care. The court will lose its ability to select its clerks. We'll take away a patronage system that has corrupted the legal profession. And the court will lose its ability to choose cases. Remember, much of the court's procedure is already by statute. The building, the clerks, the ability to choose cases, all of that already determined by Congress. And what Congress can give, Congress can take away. The only thing the Constitution mandates is that there shall be a Supreme Court, and it gives it a very narrow original jurisdiction. Disputes between states, disputes involving ambassadors, impeachments, that kind of thing. So I know I said I support expanding the court, but I also said that was small ball. The other thing you could do, totally constitutionally, is restrict the court exclusively to its original jurisdiction, to end its ability to hear appeals, and then instead to create a new national appeals court comprised of judges from all the existing circuits. We're already having full-on judicial expansion, and so we're going to create a couple more circuits. Let's say we have 15 total circuits, and each circuit sends two judges to this national appeals court. A random panel of 9 judges chooses cases, and a random panel of 9 judges hears cases. The original Supreme Court can, again, hear whatever's in its original jurisdiction. If that sounds too extreme to you, then the other option is just to expand the Supreme Court, give it 20 justices, 21 justices, and have it hear cases based off of randomly selected panels. I'm sure there are other options we can think of here, but the goal is not simply to make the court something that is favorable to my views. The goal is to make the court weaker. The goal is to make it more difficult to game the court's decision-making. The goal is to uncapture the court, to transform it into an actual court and not some tool of partisan and ideological control. There is simply no other choice here. We can have government by judges or we can have government by the people, but we cannot have both. We cannot have both. The Supreme Court is corrupt and it is well past time that we did something about it.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know if I would make like a whole national court of appeals, but there's some similar to stuff I've said. I think we should have way more justices. I think we should have a couple judges per circuit. It'd be nice if the justices could make decisions in circuit courts again.